Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn more about a new film featuring the state of Ohio. Jay Fox will talk to farmers about the Make America Healthy Again initiative. He'll also talk to a turkey expert just in time for Thanksgiving, and he'll have more information about a scholarship program for veterans and public servants. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, from soaring with bald eagles to lighting up the night sky with fireflies, the new film Ohio Wild at Heart offers an exclusive adventure through Ohio's great outdoors. Joining me today is Ohio Department of Natural Resources Director Mary Mertz. Director Mertz, thank you so much for joining us. First off, what is Ohio Wild at Heart, and what can viewers of this new film expect?
Ohio Wild at Heart is our new IMAX movie. It's about a 45-minute movie that will take the viewers from the islands of Lake Erie down to the banks of the Ohio River, and show them all of the natural beauty we have here in Ohio. It highlights fun things you can do in these beautiful places. It highlights some conservation success stories and how we're working hard to protect the land. And really the theme of the movie is, you know, we protect nature because nature protects us. That's really the theme we're trying to get across. And we're trying to get people excited about Ohio's beautiful outdoors.
I've watched the trailer, and I have to say, it looks absolutely spectacular, and it's important to also note that Ohio native and Buckeye great Archie Griffin is the narrator of this film, giving it even more of that Buckeye flavor, shall we say. Tell me, why was it so important for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to be involved in this project?
Our job every day is to help people better understand and help educate them about the outdoors, right? Our environment, and to bring them along to develop future generations of conservationists. You know, we've only got one planet, and we all need to plan ahead and work together to preserve it. So it's really about sparking curiosity and excitement about protecting our land. But you mentioned Archie Griffin. We were super excited he agreed to do this, because we think, you know, what an outstanding individual and somebody who really, he does a fantastic job as a narrator.
The film also highlights conservation success stories. Can you share one of your favorites from the film?
Well, I think, you know, it leads off with the one that is sort of the most iconic, and that's the return of the bald eagle. You know, back in the 70s, there were only 4 nesting pair here in Ohio. And today there's nearly 1,000 nesting pairs. I mean, we are in great shape. And it really shows that being intentional and thoughtful and developing the right habitat and taking the right steps, we can really make a difference.
What are some of the Ohio locations that audiences will recognize on the screen?
You know, the places that we feature range from, of course, Hocking Hills. There's so much beauty there. So we tell a few stories in the Hocking Hills region. But it ranges from the Shawnee State Park down on the Ohio River to Marblehead Lighthouse on the shores of Lake Erie. We feature John Bryan, which is also, you know, a fairly short drive from Columbus. You know, several Mohican and Penderson and Mosquito Lake. So a lot of beautiful parks, but also some wildlife areas. So Appalachian Hills Wildlife Area is featured, as well as McGee Marsh, a great birding venue.
What do you hope viewers take away from this film?
First of all, pride in Ohio, right? This is our state. It is beautiful. And everyone, you know, should recognize that. So I hope they take away some pride. But I hope it sparks their curiosity. I hope they want to learn more about the outdoors and all the things they can enjoy and how they can help preserve it. And finally, we'd love to see people be moved to action. You know, what can they do to be part of the conservation community?
And finally, how did this film come together? What inspired it?
You know, when Governor DeWine was elected, he came in with, you know, a pretty big agenda for this department. And part of it was, you know, he really challenged us. He said, be creative, be innovative, figure out a way to connect with people, to help them learn about, appreciate, and be part of our beautiful outdoors. And so Since that time, we have, used so many different platforms, from social media to written materials to classes to everything. And this was sort of, an off-the-wall idea. An IMAX movie. People love them, especially at science museums. And we hope that's an audience we can really inspire with this. And so, it was really his challenge to us. The idea developed. It took a while for us to figure out we could actually get it done. And, we went on from there.
Well, the film has premiered around the state at different locations, and now we're excited to have it on the big IMAX screen at COSI here in Columbus, now playing Don't Miss It. And director Mary Mertz of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, is there anything else that you wanted to let us know about the new movie, Ohio Wild at Heart?
We're very excited. We're excited to partner with COSI, a longtime partner for us in many different ways. And we hope people love it and helps them fall in love with Ohio.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Earlier this year, Ohio farmers voiced deep frustration with the findings of the Make America Healthy Again Commission's report, which questioned the safety of crop protection tools like atrazine and glyphosate. Vital tools growers have relied on for decades. A grassroots advocacy campaign from the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association and agricultural organizations across the country was successful in accomplishing real change. The MAHA Commission's recommendation report, released last month, shifts away from targeting widely used crop protection tools and instead emphasizes innovation, stewardship, and regulatory transparency. Tyler Dravis from Dravis Farms in Northwest Ohio and Eric Tipton, a farmer from Jeffersonville in Fayette County, as a matter of fact, they both join us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss what happened. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Good morning, Jay.
What was your first reaction when you became aware of and read that first Make America Healthy Again report?
Yeah, Jay, Tyler here. When that first MAHA report came out, obviously it raised some concerns. It had some wording in there that made us as farmers take a step back and say, hey, we don't necessarily agree with what is being presented in this report. And we want to make sure our voices are heard as farmers, that they have the right information and have some dialogue with farmers that can express how valuable these types of herbicides are to our farms. And with that, that's what kind of kicked off our trips and talks to Washington with our representatives and senators to make sure that they had all the necessary information presented to them before the next report came out.
For those that are not in the ag community, how does using atrazine and glyphosate help Ohio farmers, and why has it been considered safe for so many decades?
Yeah, Jay, Eric here. As we talk about atrazine and we talk about glyphosate, I mean, these tools are, vitally important to controlling, for example, weeds like grass and corn crop. Years ago, before we had this technology and these tools, we used to, cultivate corn, which took days and days and burn a lot of diesel fuel and destroyed a lot of soil structure and released a lot of carbon. And we've come a long way since then. And, when you talk about trying to feed and fuel America, that requires bushels. And, as technology gets better, yields get better, and all around do a better job of controlling weeds. So weed control is vitally important to raising a corn crop for those, that may not be as familiar with what a grass infestation or a weed infestation could do to a growing crop.
I got to tell you, the sweet corn in Ohio this year was fantastic. And I've been eating sweet corn in Ohio for 57 years, so I can speak with enthusiasm. How did the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association force this policy shift? What did you guys do?
Yeah, I can take that one, Jay. Tyler again. So when that Maha initial report came out, we worked, Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association worked with our national partner, National Corn Growers Association, and we had a lot of conversation there and knew that the organizations, both NCJ and Ohio at the state level, needed to reach out to our elected officials, our representatives and senators, and make sure that they had all the information, not just the information that was presented in that report. So with that, we revved up and went to D.C. and spoke with our senators and representatives and met with them in their offices and said, hey, here's what's going on from our perspective as farmers, people who use these products on a regular basis, and their availability and valuableness to us as growers. And we also went over, a lot of the past regulatory frameworks that's been done. There's been a lot of reviews done on these products in the past that have shown them to be safe. And we presented that information. They listened to us, and we came out on top with what we consider a win with those specific herbicides not being targeted in the final report.
One of the things that the September 9th report talks about is innovations. What are some examples of innovations that have been developed by Ohio farmers in crop protection and maintenance?
Yeah, Jay, Eric here again. I think one of the neatest things that's come out here in the last 10 years, if anybody ever, questions the accuracy of some of the equipment that we're using. I mean, we're spending dollars out of our own pockets to invest in technology on these sprayers, on these application tools that are using things like AI technology, that are using things like facial recognition, things that that have the ability to, cameras on the pieces of equipment that can identify the noxious weeds and then target that specific one with spray. So the efficiency and the technology that's in our industry to make sure that we're utilizing these products is unreal. And it's a lot of fun to watch, but I think it's important for people to know that right now, as of today, as farmers, we're spending these dollars out of our own pockets to be more efficient, to make sure that we're putting the right amount on the right where it needs to go. And I think that's a really neat side of our industry.
We've had an exceptionally long summer. It's almost like summer just won't quit. What will that affect in terms of ag for the state of Ohio in the winter months? Because as we all know, we could turn the dime and have 5 inches of snow on the ground the second week of November. What's the prognosis for the winter months?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jay. I wish I had a magic crystal ball there to be able to look in the future and see what it holds.
I know you have a copy of the Farmer's Almanac sitting right there.
Well, I wish I would have reviewed that a little bit better, honestly, because I don't, Ohio has been in such a sporadic rainfall and droughty conditions throughout the state. It's been very hit and miss where you go on if you're going to have great weather and if you had poor weather. I unfortunately was in the part of the state, Northwest Ohio, where we've been in a severe drought since July. And we're looking at poor crop conditions in yields, that are off their averages by a bit. And we have wheat seeded out here that's just sitting in dry dirt that has not caught a rain yet. What this rest of the fall is going to bring and this winter, I'm not sure, but hopefully we have some rainfall events that help get the ground resaturated a little bit, to get some moisture in there, get our weed up, and allow us to recoup some of the wetness, the water in our soil structures to allow us to do the proper soil testing and field work for this fall and going into the winter months.
Well, water's good for wheat. What's good for corn?
That's a double-sided question, Jay.
Yeah.
but I try to look at the positives here. I mean, as Tyler mentioned, we've also been very dry here in Southern Ohio, Southwest Ohio. So, as you look at the positives, the last couple of weeks, we've had a pretty good opportunity for the corn to dry down. So that helps us on our drying costs. It's just like farming. You take the good with the bad. So, we're also struggling to get some wheat planted and get some wheat to germinate. But at the same time, we've got corn that's naturally drying in the field, which is a good thing. So, and we have good conditions to get the crops off as of today. So, I hope your weather forecast isn't even close to true, Jay, for the first week in November. But, moderation and everything. So
any meteorologist in the state of Ohio that's worth their salt will tell you that anything beyond 5 days is a crapshoot. So we don't know. And that's just the unfortunate possibility. What do they say? If you don't like the weather in Ohio, wait 5 minutes, it'll change.
That's for sure.
For folks that have listened to this interview and want to learn more about topics related to corn and wheat growth in the state of Ohio, what is the best website we can send them to?
I would say go to the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers Association website. I mean, yeah. Any of our board members, any of our staff would be more than happy to, that's what we do. We educate, we advocate, we have a lot of really neat programs going out there. Fueling the World is a really neat program where we're, teaching the ones that teach our kids about agriculture. So we're very open. We would love to have a conversation with anybody interested in how to grow corn and how to grow wheat.
Great. We want to thank Tyler and Eric for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
For the first time in several years, both of my children and their significant others will be joining me at my dinner table here in Columbus for Thanksgiving. We started making those plans back in October, and believe it or not, we had the menu set right after Halloween. I do the cooking because I'm a masochist who loves to cook holiday meals, but over 1 in 5 Central Ohioans say they feel intimidated by this holiday. The Butterball Turkey Talk Line has helped millions of holiday hosts since it launched back in 1981, and I may or may not have called that hotline once or twice back in the 80s. Turkey Talk Line expert Sue Smith joins us. She's got her oven mitts on, and she's ready to go. Welcome, Sue.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, why is this holiday in particular so stressful when it comes to what happens in the kitchen? It's just a meal.
It's a good question, right? Thanksgiving is all about, like you said, coming together with your friends and family, but we know holiday hosts, they put extra pressure on themselves, and it's stressful. But that's what we're here for. If it's your first time hosting or like yourself where you've been hosting for many, many years, it can be stressful. But we don't want you to put that stress on you. Encourage your friends and family to bring their favorite side dishes. Take the load off. It allows them to bring in a little bit of their tradition, and it takes a couple items off your to-do list as well.
That sounds like a great idea because it does reduce the stress. Nothing is harder than trying to make sure the gravy is perfect while basting the turkey and trying to come up with 3 or 4 side dishes at a time. And, we don't make candy jams every day, so that can be difficult too. How else can we have fun and enjoy the season and reduce this cooking stress?
Well, of course, the beauty of a butterball is it comes with over 50 turkey experts to help you prepare that turkey. Like you said, you don't do it every day, and we're here to help you. We've also this year have collaborated with Headley and Bennett to create these first time ever Thanksgiving hosting pants. Because we know if you dress for success, you feel better, you do better. They're amazing pants that we want to give these holiday hosts a leg up this year.
All right, you got to tell me, what is a holiday hosting pant? Is it like a what the cooks wear at the restaurants?
Well, similar, but then think 10 times better. They're, you know, butterball, blue and yellow. They're super functional. You can put your meat thermometer in it. It has a little loop for your towel. It even has a bottle opener for your convenience.
Oh, my God, I have to have one of these. What sizes does it come in, and is it available for men and women?
They are available for men and women, from extra small to 2XL. And every Monday in Thanksgiving, the first three Mondays, if you log on to ThanksgivingHostPants.com, you too, while supplies last, can get a pair for free.
Oh, no kidding. I'm going to do it immediately after the interview. Now, let's
wait till noon your time, noon Eastern time, and then log on.
let's get back to the kitchen. When you're preparing a holiday meal, how do you know what size turkey you're going to need and when is the best time to buy? Because I always buy too big of a turkey and have too many leftovers.
I don't know if there's such a thing as too big of a turkey, but it's a great question. It sounds like you are very prepared in your family, but you want to plan about 1.5 to 2 pounds per person. It gives some generous servings. It also gives some of those leftovers that we all enjoy. And go ahead and buy that turkey anytime. If it's a fresh turkey, it will certainly be safe in your refrigerator for Thanksgiving. If it's a frozen turkey, go ahead and put it right in your freezer and then take that off your to-do list. You have that turkey home, you can move on to the next item.
Now, you are what's called a turkey talk line expert, which means people call you and they ask you questions. What are some of the most common mistakes people make when they're preparing Thanksgiving, and can they be fixed?
Usually, yes. Our number one call year after year, and we've been talking turkey for 44 years here at the talk line, is I forgot to thaw my turkey, or how do I thaw? So it's the number one mistake we hear, because it takes a little bit longer than we anticipate. We want to plan on one day for every 4 pounds of turkey in the refrigerator. So if you have a 20-pound turkey, put that in the refrigerator about 5 days. You know it's going to be defrosted in time. You're going to keep it in the original wrapper, put it on a platter or a tray of some sort just in the bottom of your fridge, and then let it be. Once it's in there thawing, that's all you need to do.
Now, should we put the stuffing inside the cavity of the turkey, or should we make the stuffing separately and then put it in afterwards?
You know, either way is a lovely choice. It really comes down to personal preference. You can absolutely stuff that turkey. We do recommend you want to stuff the turkey right before you put it in the oven. And make sure you have that meat thermometer handy, 165 in the center of that stuffing, and we recommend 170 in the breast and thigh.
My kids have asked me not to make candy DMs this year. Instead, they want sweet potato fries. Is that cheating?
Absolutely not. Anything sweet potato on the table is fantastic in my mind. But that's the beauty of Thanksgiving. You can have your traditional butterball turkey. You can change the sides. People can bring different things. You really can't go wrong as long as your guys are all together.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about preparing fowl, if you will, is the use of fruit. Have you ever heard of anybody doing either an apple or a peach or a mango or an apricot chutney with their turkey?
Sure. And it's a great way to add that citrus flavor to it. It gives the drippings a really nice flavor. You know, when you slice the turkey, a little bit of that will go through the meat itself. So it's a fun way to kind of spice up the turkey if you don't want to just do the traditional brush it with vegetable oil and put it in the oven.
Now, given that 44 years of taking these calls has certainly caused a lot of interesting stories, what are some of the strangest questions you all have gotten on the turkey talk line? And let's see if I may be one of the culprits.
All right, well, let's see. You know, we get a lot of phone calls, like you said. You know, one time, and I kind of resonate with this, I got a call from this nice young woman, and she's just whispering, and I couldn't really hear her. And she said she just got married. She's having her in-laws over the first time. She did not know how to cook, but she had to impress her mother-in-law. And she was hiding in the far closet in their bedroom behind all of her coats and whispering, "How do I make my turkey? Please help me." And we walked her through step by step. She was so fun, and no doubt she got this turkey on the table. But it goes back to, like, people get stressed, and we're here to take that stress out. Get your turkey thawed in time, buy it in advance, give us a call here at 1-800-BUTTERBALL, and it'll be a lovely Thanksgiving.
Now, can you answer questions about other things? Because I know that one thing that plagues the Thanksgiving host or hostess is dessert making. Do you guys help with that too?
We help as much as we can, for sure. Turkey is our specialty, but we'd love to help with the entire meal as well.
So what do you think goes best with turkey for Thanksgiving? Is it pumpkin pie or apple pie?
Pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you need to go pumpkin pie, apple pie, pecan pie. Just the more the better.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And in fact, I actually put that on the choices for dessert for this year for my kids to select from. And I got D, all of the above.
Good choice. You can't go wrong.
All right. Well,
your Thanksgiving table, it sounds like it's going to be a great meal.
We're going to have a lot of fun, and we've got two cats who are going to be sitting under the table waiting for something to fall on the floor. I guarantee it.
I love it.
We want to thank Sue Smith from the Butterball Turkey Talk Line for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Foggs.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
There are roughly 70,000 public servants in Columbus and over 60,000 military veterans. Harvard University's Kennedy School is launching the American Service Fellowship, the largest single-year scholarship program in its history. Adam Farina, Chief Communications Officer at Harvard's Kennedy School and former Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about how this nationwide program will both honor and invest in those who have dedicated their lives to public service. Welcome, former Assistant Secretary, or can we just call you Adam?
Please call me Adam. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. What is the American Service Fellowship? What does it do? Who's eligible for it?
Yeah, so the American Service Fellowship is a new program that we're launching to bring 50 of America's best public servants to Harvard Kennedy School of Government on both a full scholarship and a full stipend to pursue a master's degree in public administration. And the eligibility criteria is really simple. If you have an undergraduate degree and you have served our country in any capacity for at least 7 years, then you are eligible to apply. And that could be as a veteran, as an active duty military member, as a teacher, firefighter, public servant in any other way. We want you to apply, and we want you to come to the Kennedy School.
Now, is this something that Harvard has been planning for a while, or is this a new idea?
This is a new idea. It's the first time we've ever done this. It's the largest program in the history of our school. And look, we're doing it right now because this is a moment when we want to be investing in the next generation of public leaders in the United States of America. This is a challenging time in many ways, and I think people across the political spectrum recognize the need for leadership in our country, and public servants are best positioned to lead us into the future and to lead their communities in the future because that's what they've been doing for their whole lives. And so we launched this program in this moment to help those leaders get the best public policy education in the world and lead our country into the future.
The word public servant can be very vague. Can you give us some examples of some jobs that might fall under that category?
Yeah, look, public service is a really broad category, and that's intentional. We want people who wake up every day and serve our country and its people in one way or another, and there are many ways to do that. So it could be the teacher who's teaching a third grade class. It could be the police officer who's keeping our community safe. It could be the veterans who have served our country here at home and all across the world. It also could be somebody who's worked in state or local or even federal government. We want this to be a really broad definition because we believe public service is the most patriotic thing that you can do, and you can do it in many different ways. And so we are intentionally defining this broadly to bring a wide swath of the American public and its public servants here to Cambridge to learn.
What about people who work for nonprofits that serve the public, for example, the Salvation Army, the United Way, et cetera?
Not included in this program, but there are other programs at Harvard Kennedy School for which we have scholarships designed for those folks. But it does include other service programs that are sponsored through the federal or state government, such as AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, Teach for America, things like that, which captures another wide swath of public servants.
Harvard University is perhaps the best known Ivy League school in the country. And when people think of Harvard, they think of it as the creme de la creme of education. What do you say to that third grade teacher you mentioned who probably could never imagine herself in Cambridge, Massachusetts?
Look, I would say that this program is not only something that you're eligible for, it's actually a program that was made for you. I used to work at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and I've heard from many people who are thinking about applying from this program exactly that question, including veterans. I recently spoke with a female combat veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she was like, I never imagined myself going to Harvard. Can I apply for this program? And I told her, look, you've served our country here, you've served our country abroad, this program is for you. So my message to that teacher, to those veterans, to anybody who didn't see themselves at Harvard in the past but might see themselves here now, I would tell them that this program is designed for you, it's made for you, and you've served our country, and now we at Harvard Kennedy School want to serve you and help you take the next step in your public service career.
All over the country, there are community leadership training programs, just like what we're talking about now. How is this different at the Harvard level, and what exactly are they going to learn?
Look, it's a great question. I think what's different about this is we at Harvard Kennedy School bring people together from all across the world to learn how to solve the biggest challenges we face. And we help them interact with faculty who are the best faculty in public policy in the entire world. We help them interact with students, both from across the country, from different backgrounds, and from all across the world. And we help them engage with ideas and solve problems and ideas that they disagree with and ideas that they agree with on the journey to becoming great public leaders. And so our mission at Harvard Kennedy School is to help people become great public leaders and help them tackle big challenges. And the great thing about public servants is that they've made a career out of running toward the big problems rather than away from them. And so what we do is we take that instinct, we take that great instinct that they have, and we give them the tools to go out and actually drive change.
Let's get into the weeds a little bit on one particular issue. We live in a time, unfortunately, right now, where we can't seem to agree on much, if any at all. How do you teach potential new leaders how to build consensus, engage in compromise, and find common ground?
It's a great question. And one of the reasons why we launched this program is because public servants are uniquely positioned to do that. When you work in a police office, or when you work in a teacher's in a school, or when you work in federal government, you are inevitably working with people with whom you disagree. And that's a good thing. You need to work together with people you disagree with to solve problems and to bring people together around a common mission. And so we believe public servants are uniquely positioned to do that. And we also train that rigorously here at Harvard Kennedy School. Whenever there's a speaker that comes to Harvard Kennedy School, we make sure that they have to take questions from the audience, from people that they agree with and from people that they disagree with, so they can learn how to engage and debate both respectfully and in a serious way, and come to some common understanding even when there is a disagreement, especially when there is a disagreement. And so it's not only a core competency that public servants bring to the school, but it's a core competency that we teach at the Kennedy School, because great public leaders know how to lead people that they disagree with. And if you don't, that's a real problem.
If someone wants to apply, how do they apply or get more information, and what is the deadline for this first year?
Deadline is December 1st, so we want you to apply. apply before then, and it's for a fall start date of next year. And the best way to apply is to go to ken.sc/service. That's ken.sc/service. Or if you want, you can just search American Service Fellowship on Google, and it's the first result that comes up. It's a quick and easy application, and once you submit it, we'll get back to you in the spring for a fall enrollment date.
Now, does enrollment mean we're on campus at that beautiful university, or is this a virtual program?
No, enrollment means on campus at the university, both so you can engage with our faculty members, so you can be in person for classes, but also so you can engage with other members of the community and the rest of this cohort of public servants who are going to come from a wide variety of places across America. We're doing an outreach campaign to all 50 states to try to bring people here, and so we want you on campus interacting with those people, learning from those people, and figuring out how to solve problems together.
Does that come with housing?
That's a part of this scholarship. So that's why we have a full scholarship plus a stipend. The stipend is something that you can devote toward housing in the Cambridge area or anywhere in Massachusetts that allows you to get you here.
Fascinating. Well, we want to thank Adam Farina for being with us from the Harvard Kennedy School and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Voters in Columbus overwhelmingly supported the city's nearly $2 billion bond package for facilities and infrastructure. City leaders say those five bonds will not raise your taxes. Here's the breakdown. $500 million will be used for neighborhood development and affordable housing. $500 million for public utilities such as water lines, sewer improvements, and power infrastructure. $400 million for public service. That's sidewalks, street resurfacing, bridge repairs, trash and recycling. equipment. $250 million for recreation and parks. This money will be used for community centers, parks, pools, and trees along city streets, as well as $250 million for safety, health, and infrastructure, which will fund police and fire stations, fire trucks, and municipal court. Joining me now to discuss what the Columbus bond package will do, its potential impact on those who live here in the city, is Columbus City Council member Nick Bankston. Councilman, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
First of all, just what is the impact that you believe this $1.9 billion bond package will have on the city?
I mean, it is historic. It is the largest bond package in the city's history. It's going to make significant investments in critical infrastructure. As we talk about our city that is growing, we have to make investments in that infrastructure to accommodate that growth, but also to invest in our residents of today. I think chief among those issues that I'm really excited about to see is affordable housing. $500 million this community stepped up and said that we need to invest in that. That is historic for us. We've gone to the voters twice now around affordable housing. This is really almost doubling what we had asked them for in the previous bond issues. And so really excited about the investments that that's going to make around, preserving affordable housing, building more affordable housing, and making sure that we get deeper subsidies in neighborhoods and make sure that that opportunity is for all residents.
How does that work? How would the $500 million for affordable housing be used?
Yeah, I mean, so what we've done before with the past dollars is it leverages other dollars. When we are partnering with developers, partnering and leveraging state and federal subsidy dollars to build units. Through the two bond packages that we had before, which was about $250 million, we were able to leverage and create just approximately 6,000 housing units in the city. Almost half of those were affordable or some type of income restriction. Mm-hmm. And so that is really what this is about, is about how do we get more units online, particularly get affordable units in more desirable and opportunity neighborhoods. We want to ensure that you're able to afford to live in all parts of the city, not just one part.
What do people love their parks and whatnot? What would that money, what do you hope to see that money and what will people see from the parks and recreation money?
Yeah, that's probably the funnest one, right? That's where we get to touch and feel. I mean, it goes into investments like we have Kilbourne Run that is opening up this year. It is a park that is focus solely on soccer. It's a sports park. It's big projects like that, but it's also small pocket parks in our neighborhoods as well, and planting more trees in our city. We can also see new rec centers that we're going to build with those dollars, new pools. We recently did a study around our pools and trying to make sure that we continue to build pools to accommodate the growth of the city. Marion Franklin is a great example of a new pool that will be coming online next year. We've already started construction on that. And so that's really what it's about, that quality of life infrastructure. You know, there's the things that we have to do. Pave the streets, make sure we have safe, clean drinking water. But to have a city where families thrive, we have to have those amenities like our great parks and recreation centers.
And you also have to keep the police and fire departments staffed and equipped.
Absolutely.
And a lot of $250 million going for that type of thing.
Absolutely. Safety is our top priority for any, I think, government, and particularly here at the city. And so building newer facilities for our firefighters and for our police officers, making sure that they have the best equipment and tools necessary to keep us all safe. Particularly proud of what we've been doing with our fire stations, making sure that they are up to date with the most best technology to keep our firefighters safe, because they're out there on the front lines every single day in some very dangerous conditions. And so making sure that we can do everything we can to keep them safe as while they protect us and keep us safe.
We've heard this will not raise taxes.
Yep.
What does the city have in place to ensure that it won't impact people's taxes that way?
You know, we've historically, we've put in guardrails for us. We are unique in that our bond sales and debt is backed by income tax, not property tax. So what you saw on your ballot, it absolutely said this can raise your taxes by this amount. You're basically, what the voters are basically doing is saying to our investors that we are backing the city's debt in the event that they can't pay it back.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.